Hello. In this audio snippet, we are going to more or less put on pause what we've been talking about regarding Black America, and talk about other things that have been going on recently. And even though we're technically not talking about Black America, I still believe that the theme or the thoughts that are going to be shared in this audio snippet are related to Black America and her condition, and related to America in general, at a wider scale, shall we say. And so basically, we want to talk about a few recent events, news events, you could say. And many of the events that we will go over are sports related, related to the World Cup being played at the time of this recording. And as this is being recorded, the only games left are the final, and I think they still play that third place game. So the World Cup is almost over, but some interesting things happened, or sad things, or you could say, or weird things happened this week and during the World Cup, and they reflect a lot of things that are worth talking about. And before proceeding, I must emphasize that even though it seems like it's talk about irrelevant stuff, it isn't. And you have to understand that. It's very important. If you don't understand this, then you have a disconnect with reality, with the real, the fullness of reality. And I say that very boldly and very bluntly, because I get out angered, infuriated by the dismissive arrogance of people who think that they know what's important, they understand what's important, and that they are concerned about the relevant things of life, and not about like side things, as if these side things had nothing to do with the core flow of events. And people who think like that don't understand the interconnectedness of everything in human activity, and how even sporting events are what I would call proxy wars, in a sense that it's as if in those games, certain forces are acting and playing each other out, and in a sense, in that war, in that game or contest, that battle, there's like a decision being made for or against something, and it has influences that go outside of that game. It's as if in that game, there's a symbolic fighting, like two representatives of two different forces, shall we say, clashing against each other, and the victor of that proxy war then, in a sense, has victory in a wider scale. So, because of the interconnectedness of human activity, things are sewn into the game, you could say, by things from the outside, and then things are reaped from the game that are harvested on the outside. So things go into the game, they play each other out, then there's a consequence, there's a result, and that result then spills out into the rest of the human scope, especially because sports draw the attention of people. And as the attention of people are drawn, then the influence of that game has a wider scope of consequence on the lives of people. It's all because of the interconnectedness of human activity. There's a flow of things. And people who don't understand that are the ones who stupidly dismiss certain things as being trivial or irrelevant, without understanding, without seeing the internal dynamic of what's going on in that supposedly trivial event or trivial fact or circumstance. And that disconnect that people have is what also leads to them not understanding why things happen. And I think we spoke a little bit about that last time in the previous audio snippet, about how people complain about, you know, why did this happen? You know, like that lady in Alabama, I think, that we were talking about last time, the black lady, the 82-year-old lady, who was asking God, why am I going to jail? Why is this happening? Because I didn't pay his, I think it was $77.80 rubbish bill. So the police went to arrest her because she was delinquent on her payment. And she was asking why, and we try to explain kind of like, well, there are consequences to things that you do, and you don't realize that there's a connection between what you did and what's happening to you now. And that happens at a subtler scale, and sometimes at a more blatant scale, at least from an outside observer, like when, you know, all these people that are suddenly dying, all these families that have a relative who is healthy, 25-year-old, 35-year-old, no health conditions, noteworthy health conditions, and suddenly the person is dying of a heart attack or a brain aneurysm or, you know, things like that, and they just have no clue what happened. Well, in many of those cases, in a vast number of those cases, it's been because of the mRNA gene therapy injection. But they don't see the connection. They went and got their shot. Oh, I am protected now. And they do the flexing of the muscle, you know, with their arms, as if to say, oh, I'm, you know, vaccine strong, and I'm so proud, and I'm protected. And then, you know, they don't see the connection between that stupid event. And then, you know, then they go again and get their supposedly, quote, booster shot. And then suddenly they die. They don't see that connection. Like something they did that has unseen consequences, unseen effects, at least until the visible consequence arises. But they don't see the connection between the two. So, that's why we're going over these things, because these meaningless, quote, World Cup games, because they are a reflection of things going on way outside the scope of just a simple game. Especially, you know, with the World Cup being such an event that attracts the attention of millions and millions of human beings. So there's like the dynamic flowing into those games as input. And then there's an output from the result of that game that then spills out into millions and millions and millions of lives. And I don't know how I can explain it and say it without people, you know, questioning it or having it be obvious. Because when you start seeing the dynamic of these things, it becomes obvious. You see the flow. It's happening. It's happening right in front of you, even if you don't perceive it, at least immediately or on the surface. But the thing is that so we're going to be talking about some things, and there's a theme in all these things. So let's start with one of the games, England versus France. And we had spoken in the previous audio snippet that England had to lose. They were the last of the seven teams who had banded together to supposedly protest against FIFA for not being allowed to wear the one sodomy armband during the games, because, you know, FIFA didn't want to offend Qatar. You know, there should be no Qatar World Cup. We've spoken about that before. But FIFA corruptly gave the World Cup to Russia in 2018. And now to Qatar, and I haven't watched a single World Cup game since the final of 2014, when Germany beat the little bastard boys of those little Hispanic Argentinian little boys in 2014, if I'm not mistaken. And that's the last game I've ever watched, because I've been boycotting ever since, and I protested against these World Cups all the way back in 2010, if you follow the, if you were following the tweets that we were posting online, or when we used to use Twitter, in the account associated to the website where these audio snippets are posted. I think if you go back to 2012 or something, we talked about the omen, the evil omen of how the fact there were going to be a was going to be a World Cup in Russia and Qatar, how ominous that was, and signs of bad things. Well, the thing is that England played up against France in the quarterfinals, and England lost, as it had to be. And I remember that was on Saturday, last Saturday, 1 week ago. And I went to New York, and I knew the game was being played. I tried to follow them online, but I had this confidence on in France that France was going to take care of it, and I didn't have to worry too much about it. And once I finally was able to sit down somewhere in New York and look up what was going on and follow the game online, through this blog commenting stuff on the Daily Mail website, that's when I saw, okay, 2-1, we're good, and France eliminated England. And I found out that Harry Kane, the captain, the beta male captain of England, missed a penalty, and he blew it. And I know that that is very symbolic because he was one of the spearheads of this movement to support the one sodomy armband within the team. And he's a beta male. There's something about him. There's a male quality to him, but it's also there's certain sheepishness, sheepish in the sense of being a sheep, just a very obedient follower of regulations, of what is deemed to be proper and correct without his own independent thinking. He's not a driver, and that's and that beta male spirit just kind of got infected throughout the whole England team. And the only two people basically who were completely or more or less clean of those of that or mostly clean of that spirit, if you can call it that, were Foden, Phil, two young players, Phil Foden and Marcus Rashford. And we talked about how at the beginning the England coach was another little bastard boy, little idiot. He didn't want to get put those two players in because they didn't fit into his scheme, and he was not doing well. And he heard the complaints, and he put them in a game that was quote meaningless against Wales. He knew that he had to lose by 4 or 5 goals or something to be disqualified from the group stage. So it was like a oh, you know, it was like a throwaway game. He wanted to placate the critics, so he put the two players in, without in a low risk situation, shall we say, and they thrived, and they showed how they changed the dynamic of the team. And the coach, instead of saying, "Okay, now I've learned the error of my ways, and I'm going to act accordingly," instead of that, in the very next knockout stage game, in the last 16 stage, he basically, if I'm not mistaken, he only put Foden in and kept Rashford out. And we spoke about how Rashford, who is a black player, a black Christian player, basically represents everything that these beta male idiots like the England coach and Harry Kane, the captain, are against. Subconsciously or consciously, who knows, he said, "No, I'm not going to put that black Christian player in. That devout Christian, I don't want people like that to be considered the reason for me being successful. I don't. I'm, if I'm going to succeed, I don't need people like that." So he did put Foden in because that's what people were asking for directly, and he didn't understand there was a dynamic between those two, And he just put Foden in, and Foden was in a, was not really that he was effective, but he was not that impactful as he was in that game when Rashford was in it too, and the thing is that he was able to win I forget against whom easily, and then he went on to the quarterfinals, and he thought he was set, he knew what he was doing. And but he was playing in the quarterfinal in the last 16 against an easier team. I forget which one. I think it might have been Senegal. I forget. And he thought, oh yeah, I know what I'm doing. And then came France, and with France, it just did not work out. And as I think it was in the 85th minute. If I could be wrong on this, but it was towards the end of the game, from what I read. You know, as they were still losing, that the idiot little bastard England coach put in Rashford. But ironically, he put in Rashford and took out Foden. So it was like as if to say, oh no, I'm not going to put the two together. I refuse to do it, even if I'm losing 2-1 and the game is about to end and we're on our last, in our last minutes and it's do or die, I'm still not going to yield. So he put in Rashford and took out Foden, and they lost 2-1, and you know, and hit the road, Jack. Don't you come back no more, as Ray Charles would say. Go to hell, England. You're out of it. You're the last of the seven teams that was that were demanding to put on the one sodomy armband. The hell with you. You're gone. And all of that dynamic speaks about the theme that I hope you will see in the things we're going to share. The halfway arrogance. It's like, yes, okay, I am going to yield to the criticism. I am going to put Foden in, but I'm not going to put the other guy that I put with him that proved to be like a powerful double. whammy, because I don't want to have people believe that I won because I recognized that I was wrong. No. I'm going to do it halfway just to please people, get them off my back, but I'm still going to do it the way I want to do it, even though it's not going to work. The halfway arrogance, thinking that you can still do it halfway. Because you want to do it your way, you don't want to recognize that you're doing it wrong. So you kind of just implement enough to feel like you did listen to someone or to get someone off your back, but you're still going to continue with your way. And the son of a bitch, little bastard boy, the England coach, got removed. And the reason why I'm speaking like that about him is that he represents so much that is wrong with the England, with the male population in England. Him and Harry Kane. There's something about him, an evil thing about him, and he represents these people who think that they are living out in a righteous life, living out for the right causes. You know. Fighting for rights and freedoms and things like that, when they really don't know what in the world they're doing. They are idiots, there's a certain emptiness. They are empty vessels. There's something empty about them, and that's why I'm speaking like that about him, because of what he represents and what the captain, so-called captain of England, represent. So good riddance, but that's an example of how someone who tried to go halfway, you know, well, with one foot on each side of the line, thinking that he was going to get away with it, that he was going to succeed and win the World Cup and give the World Cup to England for the first time since 66 and have it be the result of his brilliance and people praising him. No. Because he knew that if he had put both of them in, then the credit would have gone to these two new kids, and it would have been kind of a subtle admission that he didn't know what he was doing up until then, and he just wouldn't have that. So that's how what happened. So then we want to talk about the another game, Portugal versus Morocco. I think this was a quarterfinal game as well. And in the previous audio snippet, I had mentioned that only European teams remained, and for some reason, Morocco just escaped my radar. Morocco, obviously an African team, was still in it in the World Cup, and they were the only non-European team aside from the Hispanics from the little bastard country called Argentina. So Morocco did play against Portugal, and I didn't know what to think of the whole thing. Portugal, in a sense, were doing things right, in the sense that they started taking out Ronaldo. We talked about that. Cristiano Ronaldo, their most famous player, that many consider one of the greatest of all time. I really don't think he's in that category, to be frank. as well as the other Argentinian little bastard that many people think is also in that category of greatest of all time, and no, not even close. But the thing is that Cristiano Ronaldo was a very good player, but the problem is he was a whiny little boy. You know, he never matured as a human being, and he would do the "Oh, I'm falling. I've fallen and I can't get up" routine every time someone would get very close to him and just bump him or anything. He would just flop all, on the ground and try to get penalties and free kicks like that, so he was a bit of a cheater, like a little boy, who wants to win and will do whatever it takes to win. And if he has to bend the rules a bit, he's going to do it because he has to get his way. And thankfully, he's been a curse on the Portugal team throughout, since he's been on the Portugal national team. He's been a curse on that team, and they've never done well because of him, his presence. Even though he's a very talented player, there's something about him that emanates from him that just reeks destruction and a curse on the whole team. And they finally took him out. The Portugal coach took him out, and then Portugal just changed. But people were complaining that he, why are you taking out the player? This our best player, supposedly. But the thing is that so Portugal had this on going for them. So I said maybe they're going to win, but I was kind of ambivalent. I just wasn't sure who was supposed to win in this proxy war. And then as I was following the game, I realized, oh my goodness, interesting, because I saw in the blog that one of the Portuguese players apparently just he had the ball dribbling into the box and he felt a Moroccan player or something behind him, and he could have had a chance to shoot and score. Or try to score, and instead of that, because he felt the Moroccan player next to him, he just threw himself into the ground, and because of that, he didn't take the shot, and he was trying to draw a penalty, and because the referee saw the whole thing, realized that it was just him acting, he didn't call a penalty, and the Portuguese players went irate against the referee, and the captain of the Portuguese team just arguing, complaining to the referee about why he had not called the penalty and all this very angrily. You could see in the photo in their faces. And that said to me, oh, okay. So even though Ronaldo is not there, his attitude, his spirit has infected other players, so that in a sense, even though he's not physically on the pitch, he is there in the attitude of his fellow players. And I said, okay, so it's a Portuguese infection of this attitude of gamesmanship, but in a bad way, trying to manipulate and do enough trickery to get what they need. And they didn't need to do that. And that's when I realized, okay, even though the coach did a good thing and took out Ronaldo, Portugal went halfway. Instead of saying, okay, let's get rid of the entire spirit of Ronaldo. Let's act like professional players, like good players. We have the talent, and fate is on our side. And we can do it. We can make it happen. Instead of taking the attitude, they said, no, we have to resort to trickery and sneakiness to win. And that's how they ended up losing to Morocco 1-0. So it's a halfway attitude. And they put in Ronaldo, I think, on the 51st minute or something in the second half. But he really wasn't that effective. And the thing is that Portugal had a halfway problem in the sense they took out Ronaldo, but only halfway because he was physically taken out. But a part of him was living inside the Portuguese players, in a sense, on the pitch. And they started acting like Ronaldo, like crybabies and things like that. And that was enough. Even though they were not fully Ronaldo, they were halfway Ronaldo. And that was enough for them to lose to Morocco in the shocking upset, 1-0. So another case of a halfway of people going halfway. And then we have another game that happened in the quarterfinals. It was Argentina versus Croatia. And I was confident in Croatia. I believed Croatia had the power, the authority to beat Argentina. And I remember that day because I follow the games and it's like I'm there following every play, making sure that the right winner wins, this proxy war. But for some reason, and I don't know if this is my fault or not in a sense, I know this is sounding crazy, but I really don't care. I said I only kind of followed it for 20 minutes and then went out on my lunch break. And I said to myself, shoot, I have followed it the whole way through. It kind of like postponed my lunch until the end of the match. But I didn't want to do that. So I only followed it for 20 minutes and then I went out. But I had this uneasiness, like Croatia was, they didn't have the confidence that they had before. I could feel it even before the game. There was something amiss. But I wasn't sure. But I said, no, they can beat these little bastard boys, the Hispanics. And the weird thing is when I went out to lunch, I could see Hispanics everywhere. I mean, they are kind of like cockroaches here in the city where I am in Hoboken, New Jersey. There used to be fewer, but they are spreading. So you see them every now and then. But that day when I went out, it was like everywhere. They were everywhere. I could feel it, and they were running. Walking into me, like getting in my way. It's like there's this thing like we're here and you cannot do anything about it. And at one point, I was waiting to cross the street, and I saw that the light had turned red on the street, you know, that I was about to cross. And I was about to cross, and I saw a car coming. I was on the far side, you could say, of the intersection. The car was coming, so the car had the light was turning red on the car. He had to stop, but he did. He just kept going, and he went across the intersection onto the crosswalk where I would have been crossing. But because I saw him coming and I saw him accelerating and I knew that he was not going to stop on the red light, I didn't step on the crosswalk. And I kind of regret not doing that. I sometimes, like when I think about that moment, I wonder if I should in retrospect have just boldly gotten on the crosswalk and started walking and forced him to put on the brakes and stop. But I don't know. I was just analyzing, and there was something in the air, and I didn't do it. So I just stayed on, you know, and didn't get on the crosswalk, and the car blew right by, just went by, you know, blowing the red light. And as he was going by, I would, you know, raise my hands at him as to say, "What the hell?" And I looked at him, and he was a Hispanic. He looked like kind of like a little black, a little Hispanic, maybe kind of Caribbean, kind of like mulatto, that kind of look that Caribbean Hispanics have sometimes. And he looked at me like, "What?" And he just kept going. And then I saw, and then I crossed the street, and I saw his license plate, and it was from Florida. And that drew my attention. So he must have been, I have this feeling he was Caribbean, like maybe Dominican or Puerto Rican or whatever the hell he was. And he could have, so, and I felt like it was a threat. Like, we're going to violate the law. We're going to break the law and do things our way illegally, but we're going to get our way. And that's what he did figuratively, as he blew the red light, and he could have hit me, because I could have just, if I was not paying attention, I could have just said, "Okay, now the light is red, I can cross now." And so, but it was this challenge thing. And then when I went to the place where I go and sit down outside to drink my coffee and feed the seagulls, the Hispanics were there when I left. They were running into me. It was like there was this constant thing. I said, "Where are all these cockroaches coming from?" And it was as if they were moving. They were being stirred by this game that was being played. When I returned from my lunch break, I was shocked to see that Argentina were up 3-0, I think. And I said, "Oh my goodness." And it was too late. It was like the 85th minute or something like that. And I knew, okay, the game is lost. And then when I saw the blog describing the game, turns out that, and I did see this before going out to the lunch break, that Messi apparently threw himself in the penalty box. You know, the way they always do, these trashy little Hispanic type players. This low quality little son of a bitch called Messi, you know, was dribbling the ball, and he went into the penalty box, and no one hit him, but he just threw himself to the ground, and he thought he was going to get a penalty. And he looked at the referee. There's a photo of him like looking at the referee on the ground, like saying, "What the hell?" And angry that he had not gotten the call. But the referee said, "You know, keep going." And it bothered me when I saw that, because not only because of the little Hispanic boy's attitude, but the fact that the referee did not take out a red yellow card and call him out for a lack of professionalism, because you shouldn't be allowed to do that. And so he got away with it. You know, it's like, you know, if I throw myself on the ground, if I don't get the penalty, nothing happens. If I get the penalty, you know, it's like a win-win situation. You can't lose unless the referee takes action and shows him a yellow card. And he should have done that, but he didn't do it. And I said, okay, there's something wrong here. And then I found out that the first goal for Argentina came on a penalty shot. So the referee apparently did, I don't know if the penalty was legitimate. Apparently it wasn't, because the Croatian players were complaining that the referee was being very kind of pro-Argentinian, and that the penalty was not legitimate. And then the little Hispanic bastard boy, Messi, kicked the penalty, and they scored, and that deflated the Croatian team. So Croatia didn't have that strength that they had before, and they just got deflated. And then from then on, it was downhill from there. And then another goal that was scored by Argentina came on when the little Hispanic boy Messi was dribbling the ball around, and you could see the defender. I saw like a GIF image of that. The defender was just not was trying to follow him, but he was afraid to get too close to him. You could feel that he was uncomfortable because normally in those situations, you would have a good defender would challenge the other player. But in this case, it was like he was afraid that if he did anything, Matthew just throw himself on the ground and that he would get another penalty. So the whole game, the whole dynamic of the game was affected, and that's how they lost. And I found out the referee, if I'm not mistaken, was from Italy. And I can only wonder how in the world do they put an Italian referee to in a game between Argentina and Croatia. And the reason why I say that is because Italy and Argentina have a strong connection, as we may have shared before. A lot of people in Argentina have Italian blood in them. A lot of Italian immigrants. Argentina is the closest thing to an Italian colony in the Americas. And there's a lot of Argentinian players that played in Italy, and Maradona played in Italy and so forth. Batistuta and all these other Argentinian players who are of Italian descent and so forth. So why would FIFA put in an Italian referee who would probably have this tendency to side with the Argentinian team? So it's like having a not quite, but it's similar to having a game, let's say, between Germany and some other country, and putting in an Austrian referee. An Austrian referee, I say that because Austria speaks German. They are very have a strong kinship with Germany, so it'd be a conflict of interest. But the thing is, there, and I think this was all because FIFA wanted Argentina to be in the finals, because that would give more, that'd be sexier than a final between France and Croatia, again, as it happened in Russia in 2018. So the thing is that, now what I want to talk about regarding that game is not only just how that example of how the things were stirring in my life, my personal life, with all these Hispanics kind of harassing me, the car almost hitting me, and all these things, because Argentina was playing and having its way with Croatia. So that's what I'm saying. There is a back and forth. There's a sowing into the event, and there's a reaping from the event. It's a proxy war. And the Hispanics were acting like, okay, we're going to do whatever the hell we want, and no one can stop us. And you can try, but you can't do anything. The hell with you. Like, up yours. That's the attitude. And I'm sorry for saying it like that, but that's exactly how the Hispanics, the culture is all about. They try to get away with whatever they can. And if anyone tries to get in their way, their attitude is, up yours. We're going to do it anyway. And that's why it was important for the Hispanics to lose against Croatia. But the thing that we wanted to mention about that game is the reaction of the British press to the game. It was just shocking to me, because I have to follow it online. So I go to the Daily Mail website, which is the least worst, quote unquote, of all the options I have, and I was seeing stories before about them criticizing Messi after how ugly they looked in their previous game when they beat Holland, and we talked about that in the previous audio snippet, that Hispanic just arrogance and violence and mocking and all this horrible attitude, unprofessional and an angry Messi, the Hispanic bastard boy, shouting at the reporters, really angry at the end of the game, like, what the hell, and I don't take questions from you, that sort of very angry attitude. And they were talking about that on the Daily Mail, about how how angry and ugly these Hispanics, well, they weren't saying Hispanics because they were saying the Argentinian team, but they're Hispanics. They used to be, as we've said before, they used to be like separate from the rest of the Hispanics. Now they are just Hispanics. The thing is that they were pointing out how ugly they looked and how that they had turned people against them. And then in this next game, because he's having a good game, supposedly, quote unquote, this little Hispanic messy boy, and then suddenly everybody's praising him. He's the greatest of, could he be the greatest of all time? And he had a wonderful game and blah, blah, blah. And I go, my goodness, this is the same guy who was doing all this terrible stuff along with his teammates. And you saw it and you forgot it the next day. And that's the halfway attitude again. It's like you see the evil, you react to it, you become aware of it. And then you have this sudden amnesia, and you forget about it, and then you're praising them again. So so it's like the anger was only went halfway, it because it was not enough to make them see the evil in the culture. And I did see a lot of people on in the comment section, English, British people who did see that, you know, there's something wrong with the South American players. And it's a shame, you know, in England they don't understand. It's a Hispanic thing. They keep saying South America, but it's Hispanic. The Hispanic culture is evil. And the thing is that they do recognize it. There's something wrong with those people. There's something wrong with the culture. It's evil. It's as if a lot of people, at least in the British sport press, sport media, were not willing to say, okay, we condemn this. And I said to myself, the British people, the British press, should remember the quote hand of God, which was more the hand of Satan, when Maradona punched with his hands a ball into the goal, the England goal, to beat England 2-1. I still remember that game. It was played in Mexico 86, in a Hispanic country, where Maradona cheated his way to the finals, and he eliminated England by cheating, and England should be the first country to remember that, and England should be the first country to remember the Falklands, and so they should not be saying all these praiseworthy things about, if they were really that good, they were a quality team of people of character and integrity, then yeah, go ahead, praise them if you want. But these are thugs, worthless thugs. And instead of reacting in a full committed way against that evil, they're acting halfway. It's like, okay, yeah, I remember you last week being this thug and this evil person, but now I see you as a good person because I see some good qualities in you, and I'm going to forget all the bad stuff. That halfway anger, that manifests itself in so many spheres, and it's part of why we are in the mess we are now. And the thing is that then I saw a story about how the Argentinian people were celebrating, you know, massively on the street because of their victory. And how the Argentina people are, quote, were inspired by their team. And it's what I'm saying about how these sporting events are sown into and reap a harvest, a good or a bad harvest. So all these people are being energized by this, by their team, this evil nation. And the thing is, the story was talking about how, you know, these people need help because their economy is in the tank. Everything is very bad in Argentina, and their team doing well is a sort of validation for them. And so instead of them looking at themselves and saying, what have we done? Well, Argentina, who that was one of the wealthiest countries, you know, a long time ago, and now it's a mess, it's a disaster because it's turned Hispanic. It's a Hispanic country. Worthless little bastard Hispanic country. Argentinians are trash in general. And I'm sorry to say it like that, in general. Maybe if you're Argentinian, you as an individual are not trash, but collectively you are trash. And most of you are trash now, unfortunately. It's so sad to say because you were a beautiful country years ago. The thing is that instead of them, you know, having things really go really, really bad until they have a moment where they reflect and go, okay, we have to change our ways, then these thugs who are winning by cheating in the World Cup, they are giving Argentinians the idea that, no, we're not as bad as we think we are. So we just have to turn it around a little bit and we'll be okay. See what I'm saying? Like, you know, in the Bible, it talks about the prodigal son. You know the story. He had to go all the way down to the lowest level to finally realize how wrong he had been conducting himself in his life. But if you kind of enable people halfway, you know, and don't let them go all the way down to their descent, then you don't let them reach the point of repentance, of transformation. And the problem is, you know, Argentina is never going to repent. It's a bastard country. It will burn in hell. It's a worthless country. Its calling is gone, just like America seems to be on its way to being in less than 9 months. But what I'm saying is the repercussions of the people who are like them, the Hispanics all over the world, they are emboldened by this and they feel like, okay, we can get away with it. We are not going to be punished and exterminated from the face of the earth. We are going to continue thriving with our cheating, our trickery, our violation of laws and principles and disrespect for other human beings, which is a kind of a constant Hispanic theme. Hispanics don't respect human beings. They don't respect other people. If they can beat you down and take advantage of you, they will do it, as long as they can get away with it. And that's what this is doing. And it's emboldening a nation of people who are a disaster. The Argentinian economy is a disaster. The country is a disaster. But they feel like, oh, we're not a disaster because our team is winning in the World Cup. So they're injecting energy, evil energy into evil people. And not only Argentinian Hispanics, but Hispanics all over the world, including the ones that live in the city where I live. And so I have to put up with that, the consequences of that. So the halfway theme here is the reaction, the British reaction to this evil. And it kind of is a reflection also of, for example, in a wider sense of what happened with Trump. During the Trump years here in the US, the economy was doing great. And that made conservatives feel, hey, we're validated. We just needed a good guy in office and things are okay. But behind the scenes, things were still falling apart. So there was just this external facade of things being well. But behind the scene, behind the surface, the Trump administration was messed up. And that's why, you know, there was a lot of and even looking at the economy, even though the economy was doing well, the national debt was still rising and rising and rising. But it's like, no, we just focus on the little good thing and forget about all the bad stuff. That's the halfway, you know, lens, where we only want to focus on the things that validate whatever the hell we believe in, even if it's wrong, and ignore all the bad signs that are saying, hey, what you're doing, what you're believing in, your ideology is messed up, it's wrong. So it's like this surface little piece of pastry that is put before us, and we get distracted by the pastry. And that's kind of the same. So in Argentina, the economy's bad, but our cheaters in the World Cup are doing well. So that validates us. This is kind of the reverse in the Trump scenario with conservatives, Trump supporters. The economy is good, so that validates that we are right. But all the other things that were going wrong that led to the cheating, led to all the things that happened afterwards, they completely ignored that. Because if they did, they would have to, if they focused on that, they would have to admit Trump is not what they think he is. He's not this brilliant master 3D chess player that we all think he is. But they didn't want to focus on that. So they just focused on one little thing. The same thing with the liberals. Again, on a flip side, the economy's tanking. It's a disaster. The senile bastard in the White House, he's driving the economy to the ground. Inflation is up. Unemployment is way up. And everything is so bad. But they focus on these little insignificant things. And suddenly, when the economy, every time a Democrat gets in office, the economy goes to the tank. And the news stories are about how to live through the rough times, how to save money, how to do these things, and oh, sometimes being unemployed is an opportunity to try new hobbies and things like that. You know, and obviously, and when a Republican is in office and there's 3% unemployment, they complain about how the Republican economy is repressing the minorities, and that most of the 3% are non-whites, and that talks about the racism. So they always put this all over the top negative spin on any little bad thing, but when it's a Democrat in office, then they try to paint every bad economic situation as rosily as they can. And it's this halfway thinking, but we are winning in the liberal issues. You know, now we are promoting, we have more transsexuals in the military, we have all of this, while the economy is going to hell, but they just focus on the little thing that makes them, that validates their ideology. And they don't realize don't want to see the bigger picture. So, okay, so now let's talk a little bit about another game. It was between France and Morocco. So Morocco beat Portugal and then played against France in the semifinal. And I had confidence in France. I said, okay, they are going to win somehow. But it was interesting to me that when Morocco beat Portugal, the guy that was doing the blogging that I was following, at the end of the game, he was like rejoicing, and we're talking about a British guy. He said something like, I'm paraphrasing, but almost literally, he said, "Oh, great victory for Africa and the entire Arab world." So to him, Morocco represented a victory for the African continent and the entire Arab world. And he was celebrating it, like, oh, like the greatest thing in the world. And I said to myself, my goodness, why is this British guy celebrating a victory over a European team by an Arab team? You know, this constant thing about exalting the Arabs and exalting Africa over, you know, or any other continent except for Europe, this self-flagellating attitude that white Europeans have against themselves, white North Americans and white Europeans, this constant hatred of themselves, like always trying to destroy, to beat themselves down, as if, you know, we are bad, everybody else is good. And when I saw that headline, I said, okay, Morocco's not going to win the next game. He just cursed them. He just cursed them, because the moment he attached them to the whole Arab world, he cursed them, because now they cannot win, because if they win, then it's a victory for the Arabs. And I knew for the entire Arab world, from Iran all the way down to Algeria, all of them believing that this validates that their religion is the true religion, and their terrorism is valid, and we have beaten the infidels, and all this attitude. And when the Moroccan, and I believe the Moroccan players were not in that mode. I felt that they were not that evil, that they were not, they were just, you know, good players and playing well, playing solid defense, and I didn't feel like they were cheating or doing the trickery that the Hispanics were doing. So they were a good team of I would dare say more or less decent people. But when they were given the kind of the crown of representing Africa and the Arab world, as if to say, oh, by Morocco winning, that means that Africa is doing things right. You know, all the horrible, terrible things that are going on in Africa, all the corruption, all the wars, all the poverty. It's a reflection of all the bad things. Nigeria, you know, we all know Nigeria is a corrupt country. It has an international reputation, notoriety for being corrupt. They are, as we've said, you know, living out the cannibalism that black people have been kind of practicing all this time, just destroying each other, taking advantage of each other, selling each other out, you know, as they did literally when they would sell their brothers and sisters to the European whites to be shipped off to the Americas. And so that's what I knew, that when this commentator put this crown of you are the representatives of Africa and the Arab world, like you're going to prove and validate African culture, prove and validate that the Arab world, where women are oppressed and people have no freedoms and liberties, that you're going to validate all of that by you winning. And the moment that British reporter said that, I knew Morocco was going to lose the next match. So I was kind of confident about that. But the thing is, the weird thing with Morocco is that even though the team was, I would dare say, I could be wrong, but I haven't watched the game, so I don't know, but I feel like from what I follow, that they are decent people. There's something decent about the Moroccan players. I don't know how to explain it. But as they were winning, the Moroccan fans in Europe were rioting. I don't know if some of you may have heard about that. They were rioting in different countries, and rioting in the sense of burning cars and destroying property and people out on the streets doing violence. That was the Moroccan immigrants in Europe were trashing the place as the Moroccan teams were winning. So you see the halfway situation. The team was good, but the people supporting them were evil. And because of that, they cursed their own team. And the interesting thing is, in there are a lot of Moroccans in France, because I think Morocco speaks French. There used to be a French colony, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong. That the thing is that there are a lot of Moroccans in France, and they went out and rioted when they lost to France. But as somebody mentioned, they would have rioted if they had won. So they were going to riot anyway, you know. But the French were not halfway about it. They had seen the rioting going on, and when France played Morocco, they knew that there was going to be special rioting, whether they won or lost. And France, if I'm not mistaken, sent out 24,000 anti-riot people to different places, 24,000 people to in one specific city, if I'm not mistaken. It might have been Grenoble or one of those. But the thing is that they shut down the rioting. But even so, in France, one 14-year-old kid died during the riots. I don't know if he was a Moroccan kid or what. I have no idea. I couldn't find out. But France was not halfway about it. They said, we're going to stop you. And I think France has been one of the only, probably the only team that has had this full no halfway attitude about them. It's like all the other teams seem to have some sort of compromise in them, or some halfway attitude associated to them. France has been the closest to not being like that. And even the French anti-riot police reflected that. Like, they didn't just say, oh, please calm down and be nice to us. They went out and tackled the riots head on. But you see the halfway theme there in Morocco, that Morocco had a decent team of players, of good people, apparently. But the fans were evil. And this halfway attitude where you can't put a good thing amongst bad people because it will validate them. And that's why we couldn't have Trump winning again, because had he won the way, that conservatives wanted him to win, that would have validated them and said to them, hey, we are on the right track. We don't need to change the Constitution. We don't need to question the Founding Fathers. We don't need to rethink everything about us. The Christians in the Christian church would have felt their prophets validated, because they were all predicting Trump was going to win. And, well, they technically were correct. But then Trump did win. But the thing is that, and they felt that Pence was going to win. I remember one Christian prophet hearing her say that Pence was going to be elected right after Trump's second term. So she wasn't seeing the evil in Pence. I've written about Pence being evil all the way back to 2015 on the website where these things are posted, these audio clips are posted. I was saying how Pence was a traitor from 2015 when all the conservatives and everybody who supported Trump thought that Pence was a great addition to the ticket. And I knew he's a traitor. He's an evil man. You can go look it up. I have written about this. And this Christian prophet who's supposed to have this connection with God, she couldn't see it. And had Trump been like just able to win and overcome the election fraud by using the Giuliani techniques that he was trying to use, that would have validated the conservatives, and that would have been probably in a certain sense worse than the horrible things we're going through right now, because it would have just convinced them that we don't need to change, and then the country would be totally doomed. I think it's almost doomed anyway, but hopefully maybe something's going to happen between now and less than 9 months. So now we're going to talk about something that's not related to the World Cup, and it's the same theme, the halfway theme, and it has to do with Bolsonaro in Brazil. As we've shared before, there was massive fraud in Brazil, and I read these details about the things that actually went wrong in Brazil. There were voting. They had two types of voting machines. Some that could be audited, and another type of machine that could not be audited. I'm not sure why they did that, but they had like two. Again, the halfway theme: two types of machines. One that could be audited, one that could not be audited. And the weird thing is that in the places where the non-audited machines were used. The son of a bitch, little bastard boy Lula, the little commie boy, he officially won in a whole bunch of places where the non-auditable machines were used, and there were some machines that reported zero votes for Bolsonaro, even in places where Bolsonaro had a lot of support. Imagine that, an entire electoral polling place where Bolsonaro, one of the candidates, didn't get a single vote. Can you imagine that? So there were all these massive things, and I forget all the details, but clearly there was fraud, and everybody knows it, and that's why we've said millions of people, literally, there was one protest with 3 million Brazilians protesting against the fraud. You don't hear about it on the mainstream news. It's so sad that it's being silenced. The largest protests in human history are happening in Brazil, and they are protesting for Bolsonaro, but you don't see massive protests, counter protests by the Lula people, the commies people. So it's clearly a manifestation that Brazilians voted in mass for Bolsonaro, and that's why they're angry. The Lula people know that they didn't have enough people to win. That's why they're not out there protesting, because they know they didn't win. They know it. They're not enough people to organize a protest for Lula. Imagine that. There's nothing. So the thing is that and I've been hearing the military supporting Bolsonaro, and they want to help him, throw out Lula and all this, and do what people would call a coup d'etat. But I would dare say the coup d'etat already happened. Lula did a coup d'etat on Bolsonaro and stole the election, and now he's going after the Bolsonaro supporters. For example, they arrested the Amerindian leader, who's been leading the Amerindians in these massive protests for Bolsonaro. The Amerindians, who normally get duped by the commie talk of free goodies and stuff, they are for Bolsonaro. And they've been protesting for days in Brasilia, if I'm not mistaken, in the capital city. And one of their leaders was arrested and put in jail. And the Imbarenians are angry and protesting and are saying, some of them are threatening to riot if their leader, their Indian chief, is not set free. There's an electoral court, leftist court there, that is beginning to investigate Bolsonaro, and they're threatening a potential arrest of him, you know, for inciting revolt. So they might end up arresting Bolsonaro, and his wife, Michelle Bolsonaro. There are calls from some of the leftist politicians in Brazil to arrest her because she was serving meals to the protesters. She was handing out meals to the people who were standing outside protesting, and they might end up arresting her as well. I don't know if the law was passed or the threat of the law was. There was a threat of a law being passed that the government, Lula, son of a bitch, was going to take away the children of people who were found to be protesting against him. Imagine that. So the oppression is coming, and the military have been waiting. It feels like, from what I understand, like the military is waiting for Bolsonaro to say, you know, let's go. Let's do it now. But Bolsonaro keeps holding on. And there was one meeting, one gathering. These Amerindians have been for days protesting, I think in Brasilia. And after 40 days, you know, of silence from Bolsonaro, Bolsonaro finally shows up and speaks to the crowd. And he gives this speech, but he says, we're going to do it under the law and the Constitution. Please be patient. Please hold on. And we're going to do it the right way. And I said, oh my goodness. Then afterwards, the chief, the Amerindian chief, was arrested. And who knows what they're doing to him right now. So these people are suffering for Bolsonaro, are paying the price in a heavy way, in a much deeper way than January 6th. Because January 6th was a limited group of Americans. But this is millions of Brazilians. And they are putting their life on the line, their future on the line for him. And he's holding back and he doesn't realize, no, he has to do what he has to do because the Brazilian people's lives are at stake. These people are fighting for him. And not just that, if they lose this, they're going to get oppressed real hard. So the freedom of the Brazilian people is at stake. And he's holding off. He's withholding the pulling of the trigger because he wants to take the high road and look like he's, you know, within the confines of law and order. You can't play by law and order when there is no law and order, when the chaos is already there. So the thing is that by the Brazilian federal police that raided 80 Bolsonaro supporters. So they're beginning to go real hard against anyone who dares to question the commies' coup d'etat. And Bolsonaro's halfway. Instead of saying, okay, let's go full throttle, let's commit, and we have to do this for the sake of the Brazilian people, we have to undo this evil. Because this commie shouldn't have even been on the ballot because he was in jail, a leftist, corrupt Supreme Court justice who was buddy-buddies with him just completely absolved him and allowed him, set him free from prison and let him run. You know, all this just third-world type corruption going on. And Brazil wants to find a new future, but they can't do it because of this halfway commitment. And by the way, the reason why Brazil lost is because they got Neymar back. I think we talked about that in the previous audio clip. So it's this halfway situation. They lost Neymar to an injury, but unfortunately for Brazil, he came back and he was a curse on the team, and that's why they are not there anymore in the World Cup. But the thing is that what's happening politically in Brazil is an example of this halfway situation. And this halfway theme just goes on and on and on because it's what's crippling this country. That's why America is on the verge of dying. The Christians, the conservative Christians, are in this halfway situation constantly. They don't want to make the full commitment to the truth because it means rejecting everything they've believed in all their lives. But it's the only way to rescue the nation and to fulfill the future of this country. But conservatives don't want to do that. The American Christian Church doesn't want to do anything. They want to stay in their own way, their own stupid, misguided, idiotic understanding of life and things. And that's why we are going down. And I want to mention another thing quickly. There was a story about Meghan Markle. You know, there's a documentary going on at the time of this recording that apparently a lot of people are watching. I don't even know because I don't have cable. But the thing is that there's a documentary about them and they're trashing the royal family and all that. And there was this scene where Meghan Markle was mocking, you know, doing the curtsy thing in front of Queen Elizabeth II, and you know, and I couldn't care less about all that, but the thing about that bothered me when I read the story on that was how the person who wrote this, who was a conservative, was talking about how dare she disrespect the Queen, Elizabeth II, who represented dignity and this and that and the other, and I go, okay, how can an American conservative say that? There's so many reasons why that just is not right. Number one, you know, this country was founded on rebellion against the British crown. You know, America was founded on by people who said, we're not going to follow the British monarchy. So there shouldn't be this sense of loyalty to the British monarchy to begin with. So just that alone, it just felt odd. But then what angered me more is this is the mother of the son of a bitch who is now in the quote throne at present, you know, Chuck the Turd. And she's the mother of Chuck the Turd. And Chuck the Turd is a liberal, a worthless subhuman. And, you know, that tells me a lot about the mother. The mother didn't raise this kid right. And, you know, sometimes good parents have bad children. But when a good parent has a bad child, usually the parent kind of feels sorrow for the child being the way he is or she is. Did you ever hear Elizabeth II say anything to, you know, to reflect her sorrow about the condition of Chuck the Turd? No, she never did. So to him, it was like, okay, she was always like the type of person, I don't get involved. I'm just here like a symbol, and that's all I am. So she was there when the whole, pandemic, as I call it, pandemic with an A, PANDAMIC. And if you've read the website where these audio clips are posted, you know what I mean. The pandemic was going on in England and Britain with the lockdowns and everything, and the queen was mum. No, not a single word coming out of her mouth, not a single complaint about the suppression of the English, of his subjects' freedoms and liberties by Parliament. Nothing. She said nothing. And all the forced injections that were going on in Britain, people could not work if they were not injected. What did this idiot queen say? Nothing. She said nothing. That was her whole life was about nothingness. It was a whole bunch of nothingness. And that's why the monarchy is over. you know, yes, officially there's supposedly a king in England, Chuck the Turd, but Chuck the Turd is not, the monarchy's over. And that's why this documentary with Meghan Markle is coming out, because it's like a divine manifestation that you're done. There is no monarchy anymore. And that's why it's being mocked and ridiculed like that by these two clowns. You know, Harry and Meghan are clowns, but it's being allowed because it's a divine way of saying, you're done. There is no monarchy anymore. It's over. And just like we in America, our republic is done. The republic that was established in 1776 and then 1788 when the Constitution was written out, the official one, that republic founded on that document, that's over. It died in 2008. We've been in a coma ever since. And we're about to officially die, you know. So as if we're going to get the plug pulled out pretty soon, in less than 9 months. And so a lot of things are dying. The papacy died with Benedict the 16th. He was the last pope. The son of a bitch, the Hispanic little bastard boy who's there right now, that's not a pope. He's just a little mosquito. That's what I call him. Every time he talks, it's like a mosquito buzzing. It's an irrelevant, annoying little sound, but it's irrelevant. Anything he says has no relevance whatsoever. He has no influence. It's like a little boy talking that no one is listening to. Whether they were good or bad, the popes before Benedict, you know, before him, they all had a certain relevance in what they said, whether it was good or bad, but they had an influence, like a spiritual influence on the world. Now this little guy, nothing. So a lot of institutions have been dying out. The papacy is gone. The British monarchy is gone. The American Republic is gone. And we're all in this halfway house where we want to and we don't want to, change. And unfortunately, you can't stay in the halfway house. You either make the commitment or you don't. And if you don't, you're dead. If you do, then there's life, but with a price to pay of sacrifice. Now, and the last thing I wanted to talk about, because time has run out, basically, is about this story that I saw by Jim Hoft, a conservative, and I get angry with him a lot. I agree with a lot of things, but then he gets to the edge of the Jordan and he never wants to cross. It's like he doesn't care for that. He looks at the waters, he finds them disgusting, he does not want to cross, and he always walks away. And he wrote this story about December 11th, 2020, a day that will live in infamy. And he talked about other December 11ths in history, like December 11th, 1688, when James II, the king, as he was fleeing England, threw the great seal of the realm into the Thames. You know, that was, James II was thrown out of England because, and then the Glorious Revolution happened. And then eventually William III, I think from Holland, came over and became King of England. And that was an important event in British history because it marked the kind of reaffirmed that the Parliament was, that the crown was kind of really had to respect the authority of Parliament. So it kind of reinforced the constitutional monarchy system. Instead of devolving into an absolute monarchy, England became a constitutional monarchy with respect for you know, rights and things like that that was uncommon in the rest of Europe. So it was a good thing, but for some reason, this Jim Hoft sees it as a bad thing that James II threw the Great Seal of the Realm into the Thames. I'm not sure why, but then that was in 1688. And December 11th, 1936, he mentions that Edward VII, I think it was, or the 8th, I'm not forget which one, abdicated the throne. As we all know, he wanted to marry a divorced American woman So he couldn't do it because of technical reasons. So he said, "Okay, I'll give up the throne so that I can marry her," and he abdicated, quote, and I'm quoting Jim Hoft, "his solemn responsibilities to serve and rule his people." So it's again this American conservative talking about exalting the position of kingship in Britain when we were born as a country of rebellion against the British king. So it's ironic that the conservatives have to now defend the British king or crown to get their point across. So that tells you how off they are. Like they have to now be a defender of the British monarchy to get to prove their points. So then he goes on to December 11th, 2020, and I'm quoting him here. He said that's when the United States Supreme Court, in one horrific act, symbolically threw the Great Seal of the United States into the Potomac River and abdicated its solemn responsibilities to judge whether our country was following its own laws as clearly expressed in the United States Constitution. So he's talking about this case that was presented by like 17 states and 126 members of the House in 17 states. It was 18 states, Texas and 17 other states. They put up put presented this lawsuit or this case before the Supreme Court to question the election of 2020. Now, the reason why they questioned the election was that they were saying, and this is the point that when you read this, Jim Hoft is talking about the Constitution and this is the law of the land and we have to follow this and the Supreme Court has its responsibilities according to Article blah 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 the Constitution. So he's talking about the Constitution. He's defending the Constitution as if that's the document that we rely on and that we stand on and we have to continue standing on. So he's planting his foot on the ground. We are not moving away from this. And it's like he's saying it to himself, he's saying it to God, he's raising his fist at God and saying, "We will die with the Constitution in our hands. You'll have to pry it off our dead, cold fingers." And that's what he's doing. And I think he's a Christian. So that's what he's doing to his God. He's raising his fist at his God and saying, "We are dying with the Constitution." Now, the point he's trying to make is that the lawsuit was about a technicality. The complaint was that the governors or the judicial branch of the state had changed the rules of the election without the state legislature's approval. And his point is that the Constitution says that the regulations of elections are controlled by the states, the thing that we've talked about over and over again. But he points it out as a good thing. He's proud of it. He doesn't realize that's how exactly the election was stolen because of that clause. But instead of recognizing that he sees it as a point of a parting, a point, a starting point of his argument to prove how great the Constitution is and how the system, the Supreme Court failed us because they didn't follow the Constitution. The thing is, he's saying the state legislatures have the control. But the governors, the state governors, and the state Supreme Courts made changes to the laws, to the electoral laws, and that was a violation of the Constitution. And therefore, the Supreme Court, which has the authority to look over matters that pertain to violation of constitutional laws or conflicts between two states, it says in the Constitution, then has to step in and say, "Hey, you violated the Constitution because the governor was the one who changed the law and not by state legislature." And that was the technicality. And he said the Supreme Court dismissed it, and because of that, the election was validated. And that's a day that will live in infamy, December 11th, 2020, when the Supreme Court dismissed that case. And when I read that, I felt so sad. At so many levels. First of all, if I was in the Supreme Court, I would have seized any technicality to overturn the election because, But the sad thing is, that's the ground that you have to stand on. That's all you have. So you're telling me that if the state legislature, if it was not because the governor changed some sort of balloting law or something like that, that if it wasn't because of that technicality, you'd have no ground to stand on to question the election, right? Like, for example, in Arizona, what happened in Arizona recently, where the election was stolen from Carrie Lake, that was all state legislature stuff. And now you can't, nothing can be done about it. And the Constitution, by his own terms, declares the Supreme Court has no jurisdiction over what happens inside Arizona if the state legislature doesn't do anything about the fraud. So instead of him seeing the weakness of the Constitution in these matters, he sees it as validation, this constant stupidity. And in the case of, so in Arizona, you couldn't, you could not question it because it was the state legislatures that set up the whole system. And even if it was someone else, the governor or the Arizona Supreme Court that changed some electoral law or rule, the Supreme Court has no jurisdiction because it's a state matter. But on top of that, if that was the real problem, if it was the legislatures that had their authority overridden by the governors or the Supreme Court, don't you think those state legislatures would have complained about that to the Supreme Court? Why aren't those states, the four states that they mentioned in the lawsuit, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Michigan, and Wisconsin, why didn't those state legislatures take their case to the Supreme Court and complain? The state legislatures had no problem with what happened. They were complicit with it. So you see what I'm saying there? And then it just brings out this whole broader issue of the separation of the executive and the legislative branch. We have executive orders going on all the time at the federal level. And the Constitution is so ambiguous about it, there's no certainty. So that's why the Supreme Court felt like they couldn't act, because we have been living in this ambiguous world where the line between the executive and the legislative branch have been so blurred that we don't know what is what. And on top of that, the state legislatures in question, the ones, if they were really that upset that their authority was overridden by the governor, why aren't they complaining? Why aren't they saying, hey, we have to redo the elections? So you see what I'm trying to say? The point is, that lawsuit was very weak, but we could have, you know, if we had people with more character in the Supreme Court, we could have used that as a technicality, because right now the system is so broken, we have to grab onto anything just to survive. You see what I'm saying? But instead of him realizing how weak everything is, the whole system, he sees it as a validation. And then again, the same complaint conservatives have: the system is perfect, it's just the people that we have are so bad that they are violating the system. So he sees this as a violation of the Constitution. No. It's because of the Constitution that we had the fraud. But it's these people who are living in this halfway house, you know, halfway between reality and falsehood, and they don't want to recognize it. So we are going to continue to have these proxy wars between the halfways and the not halfways, we'll see how it turns out. This audio clip has run very long, so we're going to end it here. And I hope you saw the theme of the halfway, the battle of the halfways. Thank you very much.